Can I ask everyone to please turn off your cell phones? I appreciate it. My name is Jeffrey Sachs. I'm the director of ATID. This evening, we're privileged to hear a talk, an address from Deputy Prime Minister, Minister of Housing, Chaver Knesset, Natan Sharansky. After Sar Sharansky's talk, you'll have a response from Rabbi Chaim Blavender, President of ATID and Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat HaMiftar, and Rabbi Shlomo Kimchi, Rosh Yeshiva of Orot Yehuda Yeshiva High School in Ephrath. And then afterwards there'll be an opportunity for questions and discussion from the audience. As I mentioned, Mr. Sharansky is of course the Deputy Prime Minister, the Minister of Housing and Construction, but I dare say for many of us, and for myself in particular, he is and will always in part remain that heroic figure who, not so many years ago, many Anglo-Saxon Jewish youth, many Jewish people from around the world wore that bracelet or went to that Solidarity Sunday rally, events that our children have no idea what these things were, but of course, people of our generation and above do remember those times, and if I may allow myself, it's remarkable and indeed historic that those times are past and better times, different times are here. Times perhaps no less challenging, and the transition from then to now is something Sar Sharansky, that you write about in your book Fear No Evil. You write of in the epilogue of your arrival in Jerusalem, from an ocean of hatred, I find myself in an ocean of love, having left a country where only the government knows what must be done. I arrive in a society where everybody but the government knows what must be done. This of course is written many years ago, many governments ago. Here every taxi driver, every kibbutznik, every shopkeeper is, if not prime minister, then at least foreign and defense ministers combined. Having left a country in which criticizing the government can land you in prison, I now live in a society where the easiest thing in the world is to criticize the government, and the louder your criticisms, the more popular you are. When it comes to disagreeing with governments, I have plenty of experience. But what about all these friends and supporters? People who were struggling for me, suffering with me, who rejoiced when I came home. Now each of them hopes to push me in the direction of his agenda, his party, his organization. To say no to these people can be far more difficult than saying no to the KGB. And I soon learned that defending one's freedom in the ocean of love can be no less challenging than defending it in the sea of hatred. It's of course both impossible and pointless to compare the challenges of life in the Gulag and life in Israeli politics. However, your commitment to engaging in the arena of ideas, in molding and shaping policy for the state of Israel and by extension for the Jewish world and the Jewish people throughout the world, is also a matter of great courage. We are tonight gathered a group of educators, teachers of Torah, Judaism from Israel and throughout the world. And this evening is a reflection of ATID's commitment, of our organization's commitment, to the notion that Torah educators, Jewish educators, people entrusted with the future of the Jewish people, must be involved in the Dvarim Ha'omdim Berumo Shel Olam, the great challenges and issues and matters that face the Jewish people, the Jewish state, and the Jewish land. Our topic tonight, Israel is a Jewish and democratic state, educational challenges and opportunities, is just such an issue. While I might confidently put forth the notion that all of us here, those of us gathered here tonight, are obviously committed to Judaism and Torah, to the state of Israel and the land of Israel on one side, and similarly committed to democracy as a value system on the other, I make no assumption that there would be unanimity, nor even clarity amongst us as to the complex interrelationship between those two systems. Our notion at Atid is that in order to educate successfully to something as complicated as this, there needs to be a process of clarification, of developing a sophisticated approach and understanding of those two components and their complex relationship. It's therefore really, I think, a golden opportunity and a true honor for a group of teachers, a group of Torah educators, to engage in discussion with Sar Sharansky. And without further ado, I introduce and present Sar Sharansky.
Identity. It's mainly through anti-Semitism, because there was anti-Semitism, we knew that we are Jews. And how the others, Gentiles, were seeing our identity, because our families were different, tolerant and violent, and with big emphasis on the education. And I think we as Jews felt the value of democracy, or the lack of democracy in the country, special strong. There was like big gap between the tolerance, the family, the value of the wisdom of this approach on one hand, on the other hand, and we didn't know, we never had some mood, we were absolutely cut from this tradition, but that was the way of life, seeing the things, explaining things to yourself, accepting the injustices of this world. So on one hand, tolerant, on the other hand, deep the gap between this tolerance and non-democratic regime. So this democracy was something what was lacking for us and what we needed very much. And it's interesting, when we finally, when the Zionist movement started, or when we finally started our way back from assimilation to back to our Jewish identity. And it started in 1967, after the State of Israel made such a powerful message to us by defeating its enemies and in fact changing the climate, changing the attitude of Gentiles to us. Even the anecdotes about Jews changed. Instead of anecdotes about Jews who love money, they were about Jews who have a lot of chutzpah. And so you see that the world starts changing the attitude to you, and then you feel that, okay, it's, look that there is a country which, when it is fighting for its independence, it also fights for your dignity. And that's how we became Zionists, and how we learned our way to know, to understand what it is Zionism, and then what it is Judaism. And the first books were brought by tourists, and the first lessons of Hebrew were learned through radio, and that's how we started our Jewish education. And almost immediately, it brought us to the feeling of inner freedom, of a lot of strength to say exactly what you want and what you feel. And for me, it was a natural way also to democracy, to tolerance, to the free world. I have to say that just in those days, there was a big issue, big debate between, I would say, Zionists and Democrats. The Zionist movement were saying that the real Zionists cannot be involved in human rights movement in the Soviet Union because it is betrayal of our interests. We want to leave this country and not to change this country. And so-called Democrats or human rights activists, and most of them, of course, were Jews, were saying that Zionists, that the real Democrats cannot be Zionists because we have to change the life for everybody. And here you are. You want only to live with a group of people and to leave all of us to live in Tehran. I have to say, I had a problem. Why I had a problem? Because I belonged at the same time to both of these movements. I was a friend of Sakharov, I was founding member of Helsinki Group, very important parts of the human rights movement. At the same time, all my way to human rights movement was through Zionism. But first of all, because of Zionism, because of going back to my Jewish roots, I felt enough strength to speak about my freedom, about the freedom of other Jews, and then about the freedom of the other non-Jews. And I felt this tension between these two movements, between these two attitudes, almost physical itself, how the two worlds are trying to push one another aside and to say that only they, that you cannot belong to both of them. And frankly speaking, I felt this external contradiction, but inside myself, I felt myself very comfortable with it. I thought that that's very natural, to be at the same time the one who found his way back to Jewish roots, and at the same time the one who feels the need of democratic way of life for everybody. Why I'm saying all this is because something that's intrinsic contradiction, which doesn't have to be contradiction, or which is only external contradiction, which exists in our daily life in Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. In different form, of course, in different stage of history, but I see a lot of similarities here. In fact, everybody agrees that our state is Jewish and democratic. But it's almost like motherhood and apple pie. You love all of this. But when it comes to political realities, you can find out that there are people who believe that democracy, that's something extremely important and central, and we came here to live in the free democratic state. As to Jewish state, of course it's good, but that's color, that's addition, that's almost like museum, that's something what connects us with our past, and it's very nice. But the heart of the matter is democratic way of life. And there are people, of course, who say that after all we lived in Galut for many years, we came to Jewish state. As to democratic, of course it's good, it's additional, it's quality of life. It's good that if it can be also democratic. But that's not an important thing. After all, they were Jewish kingdom without democracy, and it was very important. Some people believe that today it also can be good if it will be a kingdom. And you know, there are big political battles between parties, and they are doing their best to make this conflict even more sharper, because they believe it's also good for, especially during elections, very good to mobilize people under the banners of democracy against Judaism or Judaism against democracy. I believe, and for the sake, it's also position of our party, that the state of Israel cannot survive if it is not at the same time Jewish and democratic. And what it is, it cannot survive if it is not Jewish, because simply, in order to live here, in order to survive, we need to be ready to fight. We need to have a lot of strength, a lot of power. There is no place simply for another or for democratic state in the Middle East, or some extra democratic state that you can say to the other people, please move, we want to organize here some small democratic state. In order to have the state, you have to fight for it. And in order to fight, you really have to feel this connection with the history, with the roots, with this feeling that there is no other place in the world to which you are connected and which gives you so much strength. That's why I believe, and that's why Russian Zionists, who were secular Zionists in the beginning of the century, when Herzl proposed Uganda, they said no, because they felt that there will be no way to bring all those masses of Russian Jews to any other place in the world. There will be no way to defend this, to fight for the state and to defend. See, this Russian Zionist socialists, secular, and some of them anti-religious, they felt that there is no other place in the world in which you can do it, because that's the place where there is strong, deep, emotional, religious, whatever, connection. That's why it cannot be non-Jewish state. It has to be very strongly Jewish state. On the other hand, why can it be non-democratic? Because after all, we are coming from so many diasporas, from so many countries, from so many cultures, from such different mentalities. Even the question, what makes you Jewish? There are different answers for the different groups of people. And all these people have to feel that's their state. And that's quite a challenge for the state, how to give to each of these groups feeling that they're at home here. And for this is a democracy. You must have enough room, and when I say enough room, I don't mean simply Judea and Samaria. I mean enough cultural room, enough spiritual room for everybody, for different groups. And that's why, if you want this gathering of exiles, it must be Jewish and must be democratic. What it practically means? Practically it means that there should be no ideological victory of one group over the other. There should be no sacrifice of part of its Jewishness for democracy, or part of its democracy for more Jewishness. And that's something which is very difficult to accept, especially for politicians. What we are saying, what our party is saying, what we are wrote in our platform, what we are expressing in our daily activity, that instead of ideological victories in all what is connected to Jewish state and democratic state, there must be only practical solutions. It's something very difficult to accept. But if we want to continue living together and building together Jewish democratic state, we must look for the ways how we can continue living together without giving answers on all the questions. And I'll give you only one example, because I'm not going to make a big speech. This I will somewhat. There is one problem which maybe most of you are not aware of, that it existed, that there was a very big problem in the state of Israel. Until recently, there was a big problem of burial of people who are of mixed marriage, Jew and non-Jew. Let's say, for non-Jewish members of Jewish families, there was a very big problem of burial. First time I met with this problem, I encountered with this problem, in the end of the 80s, when I still was in that spirit of God, which is writing my book, like in paradise, enjoying every moment. And suddenly I found out that one of the Zionist families, famous in the 70s in Russia, who came long ago to Israel, their son was in Lebanon, he was injured, he was wounded, and after some years of being ill and invalid, he died. And when he died, only then it was found out, so the family didn't even think about it, that because his mother is not Jewish, he cannot be buried on the cemetery with all the other members of the family. They were proposed to go to the Arab Christian village not far from here, and there he can be buried. And the family was very upset and angry and so on. And they asked me to find out if I can help. I went to the chief rabbi. And I was saying, how it can be that such a famous family, refusing, struggling for the right to come to Israel, they inspired many people. They live already here for 15 years. Their son had the right not only to live here, but to die for his country, if he can be there. And then chief rabbi told me, look, we love you, we admire you, and so on. But there is such a simple thing, halakha. And halakha we are not going to change for anyone. Because look, in the Western Europe, there are many countries where Jews don't live anymore. There are only museums and Jewish cemeteries. Because Jewish cemeteries, that was one of very important signs of Jewish community. Jews were buried for 1,000 years on a Jewish cemetery, when those who are not Jews cannot be buried. Otherwise, all this, it will be insult for all those generations. And we cannot help them. Because it's some unique case, we'll find such a solution that family will not be hurt. But don't expect from us to give you the answer that because we are a civilized democratic state, that we will permit such a thing. Then started, that was a separate case, but in the beginning of 1993, 94, 95, there were more and more cases. In 1995, there was a tragic situation when in Carmel, where there are tens of thousands of new immigrants, there was one moment and there were three or four corpses, dead people, who were not buried for a week because families were not agreeing to go to the Arab village and to bury them there. And they got, the state of Israel didn't have any place for them, for the family, to be buried together. And that really became a very big problem. And when I was elected first time to Knesset in 1996, together with all the members of my party, members of the Knesset, we went to chief rabbis, to both, Rav Lau and Rav Baksha Daron. And we had a discussion about this issue. And we said, look, it's impossible. We want to live in Jewish state. We came to Jewish state. We want to strengthen Jewish state. At the same time, we cannot accept that in the modern society, people can come here, can live here, get citizenship, have the right to die for the country, and cannot be buried. And you know, we can win this battle easily, because it's so easy that all the press will be with us. In fact, they are already sympathetic. That human rights organizations will be with us. That many members of Knesset will be with us. And we will organize a big campaign, and then we will win. We don't want to win. We don't want that Chief Rabinowitz will be defeated. We don't want that this state will become even a little bit less Jewish in the eyes of many Jews than it is today. But we want a solution. You know, it was half a year of quite a tough dialogue. And then Rav Baksha Daron, who, to our luck, was in those 5 years responsible for the cemetery, called me and said that he investigated the case and he found the explanation of Halakha why it is possible to bury the Safek Yehudim, those who are not galactically Jewish, but who are members of the families, together. And not only he said that he found explanation why the name of Darkei Shalom, many other very nice concepts, it is possible, he called to the heads of the cemeteries, and then on the 18th cemetery, today it's on the 24th cemetery, there was open special path on the same Jewish cemetery, special path for burial of those who are Safek Yehudim. And today I was not more than one time in such funerals. With all the respect to the family, Hevra Kaddisha does it, those who want with Kaddish, for those who want without, without. In a very tolerant, I would say, way, liberal way, Hevra Kaddisha buries these families. And you know, our state since then didn't become even a little bit less Jewish. Chief Rabinowitz doesn't feel itself defeated, to the contrary. Radical liberals from time to time try to create a problem, to say that it's not enough and so on, but because families are not interested in ideological war, they're interested in practical and dignified solutions. There is no conflict. Practical majority of Israelis, they even doesn't know that such problem existed. And that's a good example of where, how we, instead of ideological victories, we need practical solutions. That, I believe, there is no other way that we can continue living, building together Jewish democratic state if, without this approach. In fact, since then, since Baksha Daron solved this problem, I always say that I'd like to be converted to a Sephardic Jew, because Sephardic rabbis, they found out, don't take it personally, are more flexible in this. But I hope the day will come that we Ashkenazi also will be as flexible as Sephardic, in order, let's say, not for a long time, but for the next 1,000 years, we will still be looking for practical solutions and not ideological victory of the Democrats over Zionists and the vice versa. And that, I believe, also is the biggest challenge for the educational system. And of course, it's very important that, you know, our educational system in all religious schools, there will be educational democratic values, and in all secular schools, there will be much, much, much more Judaism and Jewish values than it is today. And what is most important, that understanding that all this has to exist together and to develop together. Thank you.
This opportunity to thank Minister Sharansky. It's always a pleasure to hear you speak. Are you getting funnier? Must be something about politics. I have two questions to ask, and one comment to make. The comment is that within the framework of halakha, cemeteries are a much simpler problem than Shabbat. When there was a problem in Yerushalayim about closing or opening the street on Shabbat to make it more convenient, less convenient, more convenient for some, less convenient for others, this could have been the basis of World War III. So that the problem is also that halakha does not present simple solutions in many areas. That was the comment. The first question is as follows. I grew up in America. It was in New York, and everybody knows that New York is not exactly like the rest of America, but it is part of America nonetheless. And America is considered to be a democracy. Some call it the bastion of democracy. I don't know exactly what that means, but we may find out soon. In America, when I grew up, they all told us that the reason that America works is because there's a big pot in America, and everybody melts into it. After you melt into it, you can still maintain certain incidental allegiances to your past. Like an Irishman can be a little bit Irish, you can get drunk Sunday afternoons if he wishes. An Italian could be a little bit Italian. He can go to the opera and listen to Italian opera stars. But in general, the idea is that you have to melt. And once you melt, you become an American. And once you become an American, then you all vote for the same thing. You're all interested in the same thing. Now, when I grew up, I was a member of B'nai Akiva, a very enthusiastic member of B'nai Akiva. In fact, my parents attributed my enthusiasm to a kind of madness, which they insisted was not rooted in either of their families. I was encouraged. I was encouraged from a very young age to do something that would be disastrous to my future, my career, my hopes of my parents, that was just to go to Israel and live on a kibbutz somewhere. Didn't matter where. That was, it didn't, you know. And I did that. But the interesting thing is that when I grew up in B'nai Akiva, with all my enthusiasm and all my education and all the work that we did, all the investment that I made into formulating myself into the kind of person who would want to come to Israel in that mad time, I came in 1965. No one ever told me that there were Arabs who lived in Israel. Nobody. In fact, I think it took me quite a while after coming to Israel to make this rather odd discovery that there were Arabs who lived here. And since then it occurred to me, that democracy implies that these Arabs, or people who live in Israel, they have to live in Israel, vote. And they may not melt. When I say they may not melt, I mean, I don't think, it doesn't seem to me, I don't understand how I could put somebody who is not Jewish as the head of the army, the head of Vadat Chutz Bitachon. I just don't understand it. I don't understand how it's going to work. So that democracy in Israel is a course that will lead us to a kind of annihilation. So, my question is, and this is like all these things are connected. If we want to be Jewish, that means that we don't want to melt with people who are not Jewish. If we don't want to melt with people who are not Jewish, it's very hard to imagine that we could forge enough common ground to make the democratic system work as a democratic system should, in which each person has equal rights and equal opportunity. Nor do I know, as an educator, how to explain my position that we are democratic, but we can't really be democratic. So, is there a future for the state of Israel as a democratic country? That's my question. Mr. Sharansky, for President Sachs. It seems quite clear that when you have to go through the the jungle in Kenya, so you need two types of people. You need one person who will make sure there's enough fuel in the jeeps, somebody who will make sure there's enough water, ropes, I don't know, daggers to cut your way through, and everybody's got enough stuff to actually make this happen. That's one type of person you need. The second type of person you need is a fellow who's going to climb up on a tree every now and then and going to say, we have to go that way. Two different types of key people in such a mission. One is called a manager, the other one's called a leader. Now, in mad life here in Israel, we haven't got, I don't think, in the educational world, definitely we don't have the opportunity of separating the two. We don't have an opportunity of separating and having people who can only deal on the ideological side or only deal on the practical side. And therefore the question I'm posing is, whilst I was listening carefully, instead of ideological victories we need practical solutions. I'm not sure that these two areas can be separated with the victory of one without the other, because by nature we are dealing with both every moment, basically, especially in education. That's one point I'd like to make, which is a question. Second one is a bit of a request. That is, I've dealt in education here in Israel for many years, and what I do in every educational setup that I've been in until today was I set aside some time a week, instead of to teach and to speak, actually to listen. What are the questions that are on kids' minds? Teenagers, students, I've done a lot of listening. And where are they at? And religious students, non-religious students. And I can speak for a whole hour just summarizing that where the youth at the moment. But I'd just like to make one point, which is many times the students have spiritual questions, and we as educators make a mistake and give them religious answers. I'd like to clarify the difference for a moment between something spiritual and something religious. Listening to a beautiful song, playing guitar, can be a real spiritual experience. Learning a piece of Talmud, learning a piece of Jewish text, can be a really religious experience. The question is, how do we bind the two? How do we get the two to actually be together? The more spiritual our religious experiences are, and the more religious our spiritual experiences are, the more we have a common denominator. And I feel more as the years go by, the youth are more and more interested in and asking spiritual questions and less religious. I'll give you an example. If a boy asks me, why do we do Netilat Yadayim in the morning, why do we wash our hands in the morning, so he doesn't want me I've seen it. He doesn't want me to open the halakha and show him inside the halakha, okay, this is how you have to fill out the cup and put it from one hand on the other hand, etc. But he wants me to speak to him, tell him what's the meaning of water, what's the meaning of actually putting it in a cup, what's the meaning of having slept for a few hours and being dead to the world and now you're becoming alive again, and what's the meaning of taking that water which is alive. You're giving him a whole explanation. It's a much longer answer. Side note, when I was their age, I hated rabbis. Because for every short question they had a long answer, and I feel I'm falling in the same pit. But sometimes they need a long answer. They need to hear this is not just Jewish technicalities we're talking about. We're talking about something much deeper, something much richer. And when it comes, and with this I'd like to end, when it comes to teaching Shabbat, and I've taught Shabbat many times different audiences. And one of the most beautiful ideas in Shabbat is an idea brought down by Abram Joshua Heschel in his book, The Sabbath and the Meaning of the Modern Man. And he talks about
how time is much more powerful than space. We live within the boundaries of time and space. However, when these two clash, obviously time is much more powerful than space. And we know that already. Halachically, we know that because how do we know what melachot, what type of things we cannot do on Shabbat? Because these are the things that were done in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle. Okay, that means tabernacle is a holy place. Shabbat is a holy time. So a holy place, however holy it is, a makom kadosh is less important than a zman kadosh. This is an idea developed beautifully by quite a few others. In the English language, I've only seen it in Heschel, done so beautifully. And I think it was 1986, I brought Nathan Sharansky to meet a group. I was then running a seminar hadracha for madrichim from all over the world here in Yerushalayim. And I decided it's going to be the best seminar hadracha ever. I brought the Chama Leibovitz, I brought all the big names around. How in 86 you were out, you were in Israel only for, yes, you came in 86, so you were still a newcomer here in Israel, you're still a Olech Hadash. And I phoned you, I got your phone number and I phoned you, and you said, but tonight I bring you and take you back. So I said, wonderful, this is a wonderful opportunity. So I picked you up and I brought you back. And on the way back, I remember asking you this question. I asked you, tell me, you spoke about 130, I don't remember how many days you were in solitary confinement. I remember 130 days. So, as I was driving back, I said, how did you not go mad? I would be, the way you describe what happens there in solitary confinement in the Gulag, I said, I would go absolutely mad. How did you keep your sanity? So you told me you played chess with yourself, but it became boring because you always won. And then you went on to say, there was a rat, you found out there was a rat in the room. So you left a bit of your bread and you tried to make a little peck. Is that true? Something along those lines? And then I asked you the following question. I said, Sinatra, tell me please, did you do anything Jewish? When you were there in the middle of nowhere, disconnected from everything, did you do anything Jewish? So you were thinking, and you said, hey, look, I didn't have any Jewish education, have any Jewish books. I couldn't. What do you expect of me? I wasn't a rabbi then. But still, I wanted to know. It was interesting for me. And I remember you took quite some time thinking. And just before we got home, to your home, you said, you know, Shlomo, there was something. And that is, I saw the end of I counted the days. I didn't want to lose count of days. So when I saw the sun was setting, on Friday night I saw the sun was setting, I sang Lecha Dodi, and I knew I wasn't alone. And that is the victory of time over space. In one moment, in one small story that you told in your experience, this whole big philosophical idea got practical terms. I'm not surprised that you've come here to Israel and you're put in a situation that you're trying to take these ideologies and make them practically work. I hope you succeed. Thank you. The question basically is, I only posed one question. I wanted to ask you to tell the story, but I couldn't resist. I told it already. But my question was, in our reality, when these two issues are not separate, I'm quoting you, instead of ideological victories, we need practical solutions. These two issues cannot be separated. We live in a world that, by definition, they are part of one.
Well, unfortunately, because I don't have a rabbi's education, we don't have education, Jewish education. Until now, it's always easier for me to explain through personal experience and through stories. And I'll start from them, then I'll come to the easy question of democracy. Well, let's start from the difficult one. You said just now about how difficult it is to win over the time, and it's more difficult than to win over the space. And gave the story which I don't remember exactly how we were talking, but that's part of those stories which really were part of my life. I think just there in the prison, and I write about it, that was the place, and that was the place where I could feel a really full victory over space and time. That's what I mean. I describe here the story how when my father passed away, and that was just when they gave me a psalm, for which I was fighting for 3 years, I was in prison, I was fighting to get it. So it was pleasant in my life. And I started reading it, and I couldn't understand the words. You know, if you read for the first time this text, you can't even understand where the phrase finishes. And not speaking about many words which are unknown to you. But after all my vocabulary was 500-600 words, which you need for demonstrations, for protests, for giving interviews about our struggles, that's all. And some moments when you're reading it and reading and comparing different parts where you already understood it, so after some answers you start understanding everything, more or less, or you think you understand. And then this very powerful feeling that King David himself came to yourself, together with your wife, who sent me this book, together with the state of Israel, and are saying you all these things that when you pass the valley of death, you will fear no evil because God is with you, and so on. And in some moments, really feel very strongly that whatever you are doing, you shall say no to KGB today. Exactly the same way, whatever you are doing today, because it so happens that you are in the center of this world struggle of good against evil, that whatever you'll be doing, it influences on the people all over on this face, and it influences also on people who will live it thousands of years from now. And maybe in some strange way even on those who were before, because history is all connected. I have a special chapter in the book about gravity of souls, the law which I discovered for myself there. And I encourage you to read the book, to buy the book, to read the book. So that's why I will not have to tell it. You can buy it through internet. So, why I'm saying it, is it ideological or is it practical? No doubt it was practical solution for me to explain to myself why I should continue saying no to KGB. Because of this unique interconnection of souls, of Jewish souls, of Jewish history, of King David, myself, and those who live today in Israel, and those who will live in thousands of years from now. It's self-aggrandizing, you see, because it was very important at the same time, in order not to become crazy while you're thinking such historic terms, also to have enough sense of humor to laugh on yourself and all the prison, and to make jokes, and to sing songs, and to play chess in your head. It's also a very important part of being human and not to do it. But I want to say, yeah, I found practical way to have ideological victory over space, over time, and so on. So now coming to your question about, you say that it cannot be separated. It cannot be separated if we really think, and as you said, in spiritual terms and not in religious terms. Not in specifically what Halakha says, like this and this and this. I fully agree with you. Terms of our thinking must be spiritual, in order it will be broad enough that everybody, every Jew, those who are observing Taryag Mitzvot, and those who are observing only 12 Mitzvot. Because when somebody says that he's not a religious Jew, I say it simply doesn't exist, and you don't understand it. I know that it doesn't exist. And so, because I found myself a religious Jew in prison when I don't think I knew anything about Tariyaku. So, but because in our political Israeli life, we are giving our answers, not in spiritual terms, but in religious terms, or in anti-religious terms. That's what I mean, that we should not have ideological victories. We should not have ideological victories of one religious interpretation or non-religious interpretation over the other. I'll give you another example. This Vadat Neiman, this Mihu Yehudi. Again, every 3 or 4 years, we start debating among ourselves Mihu Yehudi. And for the state of Israel, it's very difficult question. I think for America, it's not a difficult question, because after all, every community, Jewish community, can give its own answer and live with this. I was in many of these communities. You, of course, lived in many of these communities. And the fact that some Jews in Brooklyn give different answer than homosexual synagogue in San Francisco, it doesn't stop those and those feel themselves Jewish. When in the state of Israel, we connect this question with the question of citizenship, with the question of what kind of rights this person or that gets or not. And we want that all these communities will feel themselves equally connected. Reformed community in New Jersey and the Orthodox community in Brooklyn will feel themselves equally connected to the state. We cannot give ideological answer. And I was the head of Interministerial Committee. And I remember when I first came with this idea that let's have Reformed, Conservative and Orthodox rabbis teach together those who are preparing for conversion, but the conversion itself will be Orthodox in order these people will be accepted by all the state of Israel, by not one. The first answer by some very respected people was that it's absolutely impossible because it was tried once in Denver and it failed. I would say, and in the beginning it was really very difficult. I remember how first time when I had to organize a meeting between some ministers of Shas and other parties and the leaders of American Jewish community, the minister from Shas could not come because he had to get permission from his rabbi, because one of those American Jewish leaders was a Reformed rabbi, and he was afraid that if he would sit with him in one room and tomorrow it would be published in the newspaper, it would be the end of his career. That was the beginning of this discussion. And then we had 6 months of meetings of all these Jews who were sitting together, Reformed, Conservative. It's not the full story of success, because there was a month when there was agreement, this system started working and it still has many problems, but that's the only place in the world where it works. And Denver it existed for some weeks and it fell apart. Yet it exists already for 2 years. And that's an example that if we were looking for ideological answers in terms of specific religious answers, no, in the end, none of the sides accepted by the way agreement. Though the system works and exists, ideologically none of the sides accepted it, because every side says on the part of, I don't go into the details, but, so that in the state of Israel, if you want to continue being the state of everybody, of all these types of Jews, and at the same time to be one people and not to follow a part of the side, we need to find practical answers on this religious question, not religious question, it's not religious question, on these challenges which Jewish people in the state of Israel are facing. And yes, and the challenge for the leader is to be the one who manages to keep all this in one piece. So to create such a surrounding, such a construction which can keep it all in one piece. And that's very difficult. Shabbat is one of the examples. I can give you much more difficult examples, because Shabbat, our party has a really wonderful solution to have Sunday all 15 days. And then we will remove many of those pressures which exist today, or the opening of the shop and so on. But the marriages between Jews and non-Jews is the same as difficult problem. I agree that for all the Jewish solutions is absolutely impossible thing. But for the state where people, some people, have the right to live here, to die here, to be killed, to defend it, and when they want to get married, they have to go to Cyprus. It's an impossible state. So the state has to find, I believe, practical answer for these people without undermining its Jewish character. It's a question which we still didn't solve. I don't think that I believe we will have to solve it, and with the time it's more and more urgent. I don't think there is an ideological solution. No, no, I am not sure that I answered exactly the question, because I am not sure that there is an answer. I'm trying to explain what I really meant. As to the other problem with democracy, I agree we have a problem, because I also believe that democratic state has to run by majority, and if one day we Jews will leave from our majority in our grand state, we have a big problem. First of all, we must have belief in Jewish people and that they will make Aliyah. They would say, I remember in the end of it, I came to one of our leaders then to work. Number one and number two, one of our leaders in the country, and he was saying that we have urgently to give up everything, we have urgently to make peace with Arabs, because we don't have Jews, and Jews are not going to come. It was an anti-Semitic. And Jews are not going to come. If we could hope that 500,000 Jews at least will come, then we could treat our problems differently. But because they are not coming, we have, in the next some years we can be a minority, so we have to do everything. Recently I reminded him that million Jews came, and he is still as skeptical or as pessimistic, or maybe even more than he was before. And he found explanation why he's pessimistic, because this came and nobody else will come. Well, I'm optimistic. I believe that my wife always, when she was in America during the years of the struggle, when people were asking what we can do to help her husband, she was saying, make Aliyah. And they were not taking that seriously. And Vitaly always was telling me also, when you speak to American Jews, say them, make Aliyah. And I was not accepting it, because after all, we have to be practical, really. And just now I was on GA, and I was very upset, because it was very long meeting, and it had to be finished at 9, it was already 12 at night, and all the Jews continued thanking one another and giving credit to one another, and everybody raised so much money and so much, and there was so much shmaltz and so on. And all of them are good people. So when it came to me to speak, and I was speaking also about terrible situation, the terror with this and this, and thanked all of them for their money which they raised. And then said to them, because they was really very upset and angry on how long it was, I said, and you know, in this situation money is not enough, you have to make Aliyah. And I have to say, not like to the previous statement, there was not too many applause. But after this, and it was 12 o'clock at night, came to me one boy and said, you know, we have a group of students from Montreal. Will you agree now to give us a lecture? I said, you're okay, it's 12 o'clock at night, 6 in the morning, I have to leave. He said, but we want to make a layer. Okay, then for now I was talking to the group, 21 students from Montreal, want to make a layer now as a group of students to Israel. Then another group to me came of kids, dozen of kids from New York speaking Russian. Their parents 10, 15 years ago came to America. They said, we have already had enough of America. Will you come? We can organize the Kenneth of 100 young people. Will you come to speak? I said, organize it after elections. I promise I'll come. I said, no, 100 people here, 100 there. It doesn't make big difference. I said, I believe we have to work on Aliyah of 1 million American Jews, and we'll see the results. No, but of course it's not, first of all, yeah, here you cannot vote. We are in Israel, you cannot vote. And but the other thing, of course, yeah, just because you have this challenge, I, in spite of the fact that I believe that the land of Israel is ours, we are the one who has historical rights, but I believe that we have to find a way to give to those Arabs, primitive Arabs, to run their own life, how to find to this ideological problem practical solution. That's a big challenge. I think that this, now we are, the illusions of Warsaw are behind us, definitely. For some of us, they're behind us. I don't think that these illusions that good dictators make good peace can help us. But nevertheless, when we will have somebody to talk to, when we will have different type of representatives of Christian society, we will have to find practical solutions, how not to be involved in the life of these people, and how to keep our state as a Jewish, with all these millions of Jews from America, and the democracy.
Before we take a few questions from the audience, I wanted to take this opportunity to thank and to welcome our friend Russell Rothstein, who was instrumental in bringing about the evening, and to his right, Aryeh Green, who's the director of Yisrael Ba'aliyah Anglos, the Anglo-Saxon division of the Yisrael Ba'aliyah Party, who was also instrumental in helping us organize this evening. There is downstairs some information on their activities, and Aryeh is, of course, here if anybody would like to speak with him. We have time for a few questions. Perhaps we'll take a few questions together, and then the Sar Sharansky or the panel can respond. I would ask that we limit the focus of the questions to the substance of tonight's discussion. Shlomo Fischer.
I know you're a long time, huh? Well, Harry, the thought experiment. Jewish you. Anyway, so but if you would imagine, that Israel was not in a constant war for the 400 years. I mean, you know, you have Jews who are demanding that the Pakistan is Jews today. One time, the chairman of the philosophy of the university was a Dominican priest, sitting in the state of Israel. So what I'm saying is that if the question is not, can non-Jews fill prominent positions in the state of Israel? And during the time of the Oslo Illusion, as I said, there were two Arab Sganasarim. One was Jewish, I think, but one was an Arab Sganasar. So I think that the difficulty in thinking about a Ramatkal or a Chutzim Bitechon is not the issue of a non-Jew if there will be a clear Jewish majority, but I think the issue is that we're just going to deal with a given population, and that population has significant representation in the state of Israel. So therefore, I urge you to think about, you know, the equity issue and the, as opposed to the circumstantial issue.
I'd like to ask Rabbi Gravinder why he so strongly identifies with the United States and the melting pot idea. It seems to me that democracy is a much broader concept, and that while we cannot here have a democracy exactly like the United States because the situation is different, why can there not be another kind of democracy which out practical solutions for the fact that the state is partly Jewish and partly not Jewish? Judaism changed a lot over time. The United States, when it started, had slaves. But I believe the United States was a democracy from its creation. So there's room in the concept of democracy.
As women did not vote. So democracies have only existed since the whole adult population has been voting. So I don't see any possible way of going back and disenfranchising the part of the population that is citizens of the country, the 20% of the population, I cannot see in what way it has any special implementation that goes back to a democracy that is working as such. I just have the habit of telling myself that it wasn't until all about independently of gender, race, ethnic and group, were able to vote. Thank you.
David Brody.
This is a question to Minister Sharansky. I agree with your idea that we should teach more Judaics in the secular schools and more democracy in the religious schools, but I don't think it is a particularly democratic idea. It seems that if you impose education for democracy, say, on the Haredim or in Jewish populations which don't support or don't see democracy as an ideal, then you're imposing your ideals on another population. The same with giving an enriched, say, Jewish education to a secular population which doesn't want it. So my question is, how would you see the limits of both sides of the coin in designing a democratic educational system?
One or two more.
We keep thinking about a Jewish state that they're rather ashamed. Shishikon. We keep thinking about a Jewish state, and we think that all the solutions that we need in this Jewish state now, which problems which are arising every day. I want to ask, why do we keep bringing more hundreds and thousands of Russian non-Jewish aliens who have no Jewish identity? Why are we carrying on bringing them the whole time into the state of Israel? If we've got so many things we have to solve now, why do we keep bringing them more and encouraging them to come?
Ezra Shapiro, it seems to me that, understandably so, as Minister presented democracy and Judaism as both needs and practical needs, and therefore when you have practical needs, then you can compromise because that is a greater practical need. But when it gets to the point that each side has certain limits to where it can compromise, and those limits are greater than the greater good of the compromise itself, then it becomes very difficult.
A lot of different questions on the table. We'll leave it to the panel to answer any or all of them.
I don't think anybody asked me a question. I think Stella Fisher said that there's some kind of a dream world that we might live in, where the one or two Arabs who have achieved prominence in the state of Israel would become 100,000 Arabs somehow. Max Singer said that there's another kind of democracy, which I'm not sure exactly, you know, how it works, that might work in Israel. So the only democracy that I know of is the democracy that I grew up in. I know that there are different styles, in different places, but I can't imagine that the democratic. I don't know if that would make them particularly happy. I mean, Judaism is an affront to a certain extent to Islam. Doesn't mean that they have to kill us, but it certainly doesn't mean that they're going to like us particularly. And that's not such a good basis for a democratic society. We do want to be more and more Jewish. That's what I understood from Minister Sharansky. Being more and more Jewish means that, I just can't imagine that when they have public meetings and sing Hatikva or something, that they then sing some Arab national anthem. I'm totally in favor of a Jewish state, but I don't see how it could work unless there are only about 98% of the population who are Jewish. Then you can have a Jewish state, but to have a democracy with internally, I'm not talking about the 3 million Arabs under Jewish control, I'm talking about the 1.5 million Arabs who live in the state of Israel, who vote
I mean, to think that the Arab members of parliament today would be the head of sensitive committees or subcommittees or have something to do with army intelligence or international relations except in a pro forma kind of way seems very seems like very difficult for me to imagine. I mean, you know, I mean, I can imagine with the best of them, but you know, this is really Harry Potter, you know.
Continuing the question again, the problem Jews live in Christian states and Christian democratic states, and they live as a community. I don't, as a loyal community, I don't see why should there be the life of loyal Arab minority of the citizens of Israel. The fact that today they look so unloyal that was a direct result of the fact that after Oslo and after successes of Arafat's building the autonomy of terror under the international jurisdiction, it brought back the idea that maybe Jewish state can be defeated, and that is a very destabilizing factor in the life of Arab communities. In fact, it puts loyal Arabs, and I say from the experience, and I have a lot of experience with Arab communities as a Minister of Industry and Trade and especially as a Minister of Interior, and today as a Housing Minister, I have a lot of experience. I have to say that 5,000 Arabs voted for not only Arabs, Druze and Arabs voted for our party. Many of these communities are willing to be, want to be loyal, since they want to have normal life and enjoy it. The fact that today extremism has the upper hand, and the fact that today they are scared by Islamic movement because they see that the government institutions are retreating in front of these extremists. That's what makes this life so difficult. From, I believe that we made some very major mistakes, both being too weak against those who violate the law and being not too generous to those who want to be good citizens. And there are so many examples how, in fact, in the normal situation, when nobody has any doubt that the state of Israel is here forever, so how these Arabs in the villages which seem today so problematic are loyal and want to be loyal. That's why it doesn't mean that we can afford to lose Jewish majority, for sure not. But to have 15, 20, even 25, and it's still a long, long way until there will be 25% of non-Jews, I think it's possible to live and to be a Jewish state if, of course, we are strong enough, we are ready to defend our law, and we are making serious efforts to close the gaps in the quality of life between, let's say, Arab village and kibbutz. We have a lot to do in these directions, and we made a lot of mistakes, and I don't have time, I can tell you many examples of it. Now, the question was about education, that it's very non-democratic to impose democratic education in religious schools, which doesn't want to do anything with it. I think that it's non-democratic and it's